and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Happy New Year, everyone. With me in studio this week is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis, and we'd love to have your questions for him during our next half hour. You can phone those in to 496-1999, email them to ask@wbaa.org, and tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, Mr. Mayor, first of all, Happy New Year to you. Thanks
Same
for
to
being
you, Stan.
Here.
My pleasure, as always.
And did you feel any different this inauguration than you did the past couple?
Yeah, there was none. I mean, we all showed up at a meeting and put our hands in the air and took our oath, and off we go to the races.
Sure.
Actually, it is. It is a completely different makeup. Now, we've got, a lot more folks representing our citizenry now because we're a Class 2. Some new faces. And in the conversations that we've had, some interesting ideas about how we're going to move forward as a city. And that's kind of one of the really cool things about bringing more people into this process. Not that all of us have, that we've been around for 8 years are losing our energy, but sometimes you get in a rut and you need some fresh ideas to sort of reinvigorate you. And we've got some really cool people coming on board.
Well, I want to get to our listener questions here, and we'll get there in just a second. Let's point out again to people, you can email questions to ask@wbaa.org. You can also tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter, and you can call them into 496-1999. So Shelley asks a question that we've asked you on this program before, which is, when, she says, will the steps into Happy Hollow Park at Salisbury and Grant be open?
We are so close, you can almost feel it. That money was allocated this past year, and unfortunately at the time that money was allocated, it was towards the end of the construction season. So we are now in a position to where the funding has been allocated. The engineering has been, for the most part, decided, and we're in that wonderful sort of luxurious position of waiting for Mother Nature to go ahead and decide when we can go ahead and get our crews back out there to get the project finished. The unfortunate reality of that, and I think I related this last time, is that due to the area that we're trying to sort of revitalize and rehab, it's deep within the woods. So a lot of the machinery that needs to be used to get that project completed has to be hand carried down there. And that's one of the time consuming processes. So basically what we have to do is we have to build it. And then immediately after we build it, we're using it to get further into the woods. So fingers crossed, weather permitting, we should be done sometime early this year.
Been kind of a bad couple of years for Lafayette and West Lafayette in terms of meeting deadlines on civic projects,
yeah.
It seems. And I can't help but wonder about the vetting process or the process of avoiding delays, mm-hmm. because this has taken a long time. Mm-hmm. The Myers Bridge is just set to reopen after mm-hmm. months and months of delays in mm-hmm. Lafayette. I mean, is there a problem in terms of meeting deadlines?
Not really. Oftentimes what happens is when you're negotiating contracts, within that contractual obligation is a definitive timeline. Again, if, Stan Inc. is going to build a road for the city of West Lafayette, we'll say, okay, Stan, our start date will be X, and then we agree, both parties agree to have this finished by Y. And if not, then you owe us so much money per day past that contractual understanding. And then there are certain contingencies that come in, obviously, weather conditions. I mean, if there's certain things that are what they consider to be acts of gods or something beyond the scope of the control of the actual contractor, they get sort of an understanding with that. But the reality of it is they are held by contract to get these things done on time. And then should they not, then they do reimburse the city. That's why oftentimes on some of these projects you'll see guys working on Sundays, you'll see things happening in, well into the night, and that's because they are trying to meet that timeline. Reasons why they won't get done are things that, like I said, act of God because of the weather, or something that's beyond the scope of the control of the contractor. Hypothetically, if there's a product that they're using, they're a very specific product that they're using for that particular project, and it's unavailable. Well, there's really nothing that they can do. So they have to wait till that product's available, and then they go ahead and install it when they get it. Or they have a product that's defective. Let's say hypothetically you're building a road and you're going to have some unique bike path things or some specific type of concrete or asphalt used and it's unavailable, there's just none available, then they go ahead and they get an allowance for that. But generally speaking, if it's a matter of putting a product within to a certain geographic footprint for an extended length, there's a timeline and they are obligated by contract to meet that timeline or else they're unable to do so at their peril.
I mentioned the pedestrian bridge in my question, and there's a ceremony coming up this weekend to actually reopen that formally. And we've asked Mayor Wisworski a lot about this, but I think I've talked to you much, mm-hmm. if at all, about it. But, of course, it connects to your city, too. Mm-hmm. Has it caused problems for you guys, especially because there have been so many delays that have taken this from wanting to be reopened in July to now reopening in January?
Yeah, in a way it has. I mean, we've got a lot of folks who live in our city that work over in Lafayette, and a lot of them like to get to work by either walking or riding a bicycle, and that was their dedicated path of travel. So obviously there's been that level of inconvenience. Some of the events that we have some communal events. We have the Art on the Wabash. There's the 4th of July celebration. We do things in Tapawingo Park. And again, it's not prohibited us. I'm having a hard time talking today. Prohibited of us from actually hosting those events, but sometimes it's just not quite as accessible to both sides of the river. We are absolutely ecstatic that project's going to be finished. That really is going to go ahead and continue opening up both sides so that we can get back and forth. And I know specifically one counselor is going to be very excited about having that open. Counselor DeBoer has been pretty vocal about making sure that it gets done on time and creates a safe environment for the folks that are walking back and forth.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting today with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. We'd love to have your phone calls. 496-1999 is our telephone number. You can email those questions to ask@WBAA.org, and you can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. We've got a multi-part question that's come in from Nona, who wants to know about the West Lafayette Historic Preservation Ordinance that's, she says, set to go into effect in September of this year if more than 50% of homeowners don't disagree with it. She wants to know, when and how does the city intend to inform property owners of their ability to either vote for or against implementation of phase two of that ordinance? Do you know much about it?
I know the spirit of the ordinance, and sometimes that's usually what gets put by the wayside when things come in front of our legislative bodies. The intent of the ordinance is to make sure that in historic neighborhoods that have been designated as a historic neighborhood, that you don't put some modern structure that wouldn't fit, or you don't tear down a historically significant house to put in an apartment complex. That's the original spirit behind the ordinance. And then oftentimes the presumption is when we empower government to take a few measures to ensure that there's a level of conformity or that folks try and maintain some semblance of consistency with their houses, that creates problems. Because what in effect that we're doing is we're saying, okay, I know you own it, I know you're paying for it, but you can't do what you want to your own property. And that's when we get a lot of people that get heartburn. But again, the spirit is such that we've created a board and we've created a commission that has, you know, residents of West Lafayette sitting on that commission. And that commission is to say, not necessarily no, but to say, come and see us. And let's see how we can cooperatively work together to make sure that this is a good fit. Sometimes the board, when presented with some ideas or some conversation points, they go ahead and they give a certificate of appropriateness for something that's going to be done in a way that's going to be suitable. Other times, they will be the ones that will call a property owner and say, hey, wait a second. You know, we've been made aware of a situation that might need some guidance from our part. Would you please come and sit with us and have a conversation? The intent is not to be a militantly negative enforcement component that prevent people from doing what they need to do. The intent is to make sure that they, in effect, you know, meet some of the standards that we've established in some of our more historically significant neighborhoods and go ahead and abide by those rules.
Well, and we should say that this sort of ordinance is fairly common. In places where there are historic districts in many cities, they have these ordinances that say you must put back period materials or you must make it look as though it was originally constructed. And so this is a fairly common ordinance.
Right, right.
She wants to know also what constitutes an appropriate change to a homeowner's property. So within the idea that this is something that a lot of cities have, there's a lot of leeway in deciding how these boards or these ordinances operate. Mm-hmm. You can say it has to be a period material. You can say it has to look like the period material, but it can be made out of modern stuff. Mm-hmm. How far do you think the city of West Lafayette wants to go?
I think that what we have established sort of as our parameters now is we are open-minded to make sure that we take into all the components, all the potential variables of what the situation might actually be in order to be rectified. Quite clearly, if you have a property owner and they're financially in a position where they are disadvantaged and would not be able to use that specific type of wood or would not be able to use that particular window cut, they're open-minded enough to understand what some of those restrictions are. But again, the spirit is to make sure that the worst case scenario does not happen. You know, again, that multi-story apartment complex in a beautifully historic setting, that's what they're trying to make sure that we have some form of check and balance on. The intent is not to be so restrictive that they're basically disadvantaging all property owners.
So Nona also wants to know how long approval will take once this thing is up and running. In other words, if you submit a change request to the city, how long is that going to take? And is taxpayer money going to be used to implement and police these sorts of policies?
Well, obviously, it's a governmental entity, so yeah, it's a tax-driven entity. But the timeline, usually, and again, I'm just going by what our general practice is and all things, you know, as soon as I say something is one way, it ends up being something else. So generally speaking, if somebody would choose to appeal, it would go through our board, and then the board would review that and issue a rendering after the fact. And again, it's up to the discretion of the board to make that determination as to how long it's going to be. They could do it in a night, or they could go and take another legal review. It might take a little while longer. So it could be from one meeting possibly to the next.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting today with West Lafayette's John Dennis. Call in your questions, 496-1999. Email them to ask@WBAA.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Another listener question from Dennis, who says, on a recent Saturday morning, I arrived at the recycling center to discover three people in the bins. They were removing cans and labels. When I dumped my cans into the bin, they became irate. He says, I'm confused. Is this removal of items permitted by the city? What am I to do with my cans if there's someone in the bin? If they are not allowed in the bins, could you please post some signage to that effect?
We have had signs up, but apparently somebody have recycled those signs. The fact of the matter is no. The recycling drop-off center is specifically for that. It's where people deposit their recycling, their cans, bottles, paper, et cetera. And the intent is for us to go ahead and they're dropped into roll-offs, and we pick up the roll-offs and take them to the recycling center out in the county. But oftentimes, because some of that recyclable is, you know, you can turn it in for money, specifically the cans, we encounter that. So the good thing about that is our police officers use that exact same location to gas their cars. So we often have patrol officers to go through there and make sure that nobody's using that as a way to generate personal revenue.
Although it sounds like Dennis is saying you could use some more patrols.
Yeah, obviously. And then it gets back to that direct and proportionate relationship between people behaving and a police car being around. You know, they could go there, they could watch, they could look, they could see, everything could be fine. And then as soon as they leave, somebody jumps in there and just starts filling their garbage back up with tin cans and taking them to the recycling center for money. So we do the best we can with what we've got. But again, sometimes it's just a matter of who's watching whom.
You and I talked on this program a couple of months ago about the possibility the city might somewhere down the line buy its own water utility. And you had said that's going to cost tens of millions of dollars. It's going to be a large price tag. And we've also talked about the fact that you're trying to do big things like State Street at the moment, and that, of course, takes a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know how that discussion of buying your water utility interfaces with the discussion that's going on the west side of the city right now. You've got a number of property owners who are disturbed by what they're seeing from American Suburban Utilities, which owns the wastewater plant out there. And there are a number of people out there who are remonstrating against a possible rate increase and possible plant expansion out there. They say, look, there's too much junk that's being put out into the creek out there. Mm-hmm. Some of these people are people you've annexed who are now in the city. Mm-hmm. So how does that ongoing discussion between the company and those people who are unhappy with what the company's doing factor into whether the city can think about having its own water utility?
Well, we just dealing with American Suburban first and the folks that are on their system, we have been made aware of the problems that exist. We have had conversations with the ownership of American Suburban. We would be obviously interested in buying it. But when we have, and it's kind of a unique thing, with when it comes to the public utility versus a private utility, one would think that the standards are the same. And they generally are, but the process of enforcement sometimes isn't necessarily as aggressive. The private sector utility sometimes doesn't have nearly the focus that the public side does. You can ask our utility guy, Dave Henderson, how many times IDEM and the EPA are knocking on his door and saying, hey, let's see your stuff. Let me check your flow. Let me look at your digesters. Let me see what's going on out there.
You're saying you're getting greater scrutiny than ASU is?
Oh, yeah. You can ask anybody that works for the state. That's exactly what happens because, again, you know, a government likes to police a government, and they have more enforcement power within themselves. The private sector, they get to eventually, but from the stories that I've been told about what might be happening out that way, one would think that they would be much more aggressive because there are a lot of folks that show up at some of our public meetings to express concern about what's going on out there. Because let's face it, if there are issues that are happening within the geographic footprint of the city that could have an impact on our drinking water, we're concerned. That in conversations that I've had with Mr. Henderson, I said, okay, let's decide that, you know, we just, you know, fold our arms and blink our eyes and we have a bunch of extra revenue and we choose to buy that. I said, how do you think it would be for us insofar as putting that into our system and maybe putting a lift station out there where they're intending on doing their expansion and bringing all that into our facility? And I don't know if you know Dave Henderson, but he's a very soft-spoken gentleman. And he looked at me and he has this really strong, heavy sigh that he uses when he's about ready to give you bad news. And he said, well, Mayor, it would probably cost us about $40 million just to get it up to the standards that IDEM expects. So it's a really big deal, but it's something that if we were in a position to take action on, I'd like to do it. But right now, I don't know. It's sort of a tough call.
So you mentioned having conversations with officials from ASU. What have those been like? Have you gone to them and said, hey, we are worried about the drinking water quality of some of our residents?
It was actually, we are interested in buying you. We met with the owner and said, how much is it worth to you? Have people approached you before? Has the city approached you before?
And what did he say?
It was an ongoing dialogue. He just really didn't give us any definitive answer one way or the other.
Did he give you a number on what he thought he would part with it for?
Not at all. Not at all. And this has been within the past. Well, it's been since we've been at Morton. So it's not been too long ago. The biggest challenge that we have as local government is trying to be able to continue to do the right thing and yet do it in a way that's not going to break the bank. And for us right now, I mean, we have a lot of busy tax dollars within the city of West Lafayette, and we want to make sure that we don't spread ourselves too thin. And with the utility issue, we are still spending a lot of money to get us where we need to be. I mean, we are doing the great big utility work on the east side of the city with a 96-inch tube and go ahead and trying to control some of our CSOs on the east side. And it's going to get us about down to none. And so we are very busy in doing what we're doing internally with our own utility. But we, again, I mean, if you don't have a vision, you know, you really don't have, you know, a whole lot to look at for your future. We'd be interested in buying American Suburban if it would be cost effective and beneficial for our community. Same thing with our water company. Eventually, we would love to own our own water company.
So you were telling us that Dave Henderson tells you that if you feel like you want to buy that existing facility, it's going to take you something like $40 million just to bring it up to the specs you would need.
He was using $40 million. I don't know if he was being facetious or the point remains
that it is below the specs that you would look for or below the specs that are necessary. And that would seem to signal that there is some sort of problem with the infrastructure. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes.
And so let me ask a different question about the annexation. Mm-hmm. When you went through the process of annexation, one of the things a city has to do is justify that it's giving all of the same services to the people who are being brought into the city that are given to the people who are already in the city. Mm-hmm. Did you plan on quality service from ASU to the people in these annexed areas as part of your plan when you did the annexation a couple of years ago?
Yeah, we when we did the annexation plan, again, you don't the way the plan is done is it's generic. I mean, you look at it in a way and you see who's providing service to whom. You know, what kind of – who does their trash pickup? Who's their sanitary? Who do they get their water from? Are they on a well? You know, or are they on a septic? Or are they – getting service from somebody else. That's all included in that financial plan. It's a component of the plan, but it's not necessarily an exclusive decision point. In other words, if somebody had ASU and they felt that their service was substandard compared to what the city would be, does that mean that they can't be annexed? So it's not that. But what that does tell us, the eventuality is there's things that need to be improved. And the folks who are on that utility, who are providing financial remuneration to that utility, that's why they are coming to our council meetings, and that's why they are remonstrating against the rate increase, and that's why they're expressing quite publicly, I might add, very sincere dissatisfaction on the service that they're getting, because they are concerned.
So let me drill into this a second. Do those people in, for instance, the Carriage Estates subdivision out there, have the ability to get water from anybody else, or is ASU their only choice?
Okay, now ASU isn't a water company. They're a sanitary.
Okay, but okay. Could they be served by somebody else?
The only other way that they could be served is if they went to a septic.
Okay.
And a lot of the folks within that service area still have septic systems.
So in terms of the city getting into this debate between the company and between the homeowners, where does the city stand? Are you taking a side? Are you trying to mediate? Or are you just concerned that this whole issue go away?
Well, right now they haven't asked us. I mean, sure, they'd love for us to own it because they love the service. They know that we do a pretty good job in providing service. But right now, the folks that are coming to our council meeting are doing this in a way to inform us, let us know what's going on. They ask that we, in the event that we are in any way approached by a regulatory agency, that we let them know that, yep, they have come to our council meetings and they have expressed deep concern, and that we share that concern. You know, we don't like, you know, hearing what we're hearing from folks that are either our citizens or folks that are, you know, right within our neighbors, so just right next to our city limits.
Well, so obviously you've got IDEM, you've got the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission deciding on...
And EPA.
And deciding on, is this environmentally appropriate? Is it appropriate to give a rate increase? And you would think you'd only give the rate increase if the service was to standards.
Mm-hmm.
Have you submitted, as a city, statements to these various regulatory bodies expressing your opinion that things could be done better?
They have not approached us. I don't know that that's
appropriate. But what stops you from doing it yourself if you have these concerns?
I don't know. I mean, the only thing I can tell you is that oftentimes when it's a closed shop, I guess, to some degree. I mean, when they're going through this rate issue, we're not consulted. I mean, it's not like they call us up and say, hey, John, you know, what do you think about this rate increase? It's usually done. There's a more methodical process for the evaluating group to make sure that it's not exorbitant. There has to be a comparative understanding as to what that money is going to be used for. And generally speaking, that's what they base their approval on that rate increase of. It's if the utility owner says, you know, we're going to expand our plant tenfold and we're going to be able to have, instead of handling X million number of gallons of water per day, we're going to be able to handle, you know, 10 times X number of million, all that kind of stuff. And then there has to be agreement signed on the part of the utility owner that the regulatory commission can accept as, okay, this money's going to go for this. You know, because obviously if a utility owner or a private utility owner is just going to try and generate more personal revenue, that's unacceptable and they wouldn't agree to the rate increase. On the other side, if there is bona fide infrastructure work that needs to be done, then they will more than likely have a much easier way to get or a much easier path to go through to get that rate increase. Because the dark side of it is that in my limited experience with this, it seems as though there is not the number isn't necessarily as important as where that revenue is going to go. And that revenue stream is generally, if it's dedicated for infrastructure work, then it's okay. Because we have gone through the same thing. We've done some rate increases on our utility. And for the first time in, I don't know, 10 years or 16 years, I can't remember what the number is, we had a rate increase. And it's specific to providing more service. It's specific to increasing our capacity. It's specific to controlling our combined sewer overflows.
All right. So while we're on the subject of money, let's talk about how this interfaces with State Street. If you weren't doing State Street right now, would you have the wherewithal financially more than you have now to, for instance, submit an attractive bid to somebody like ASU to buy them out? Is State Street hampering your financial ability to do something like this?
No, I don't think so, because I think it's cost prohibitive anyway. I mean, it would be...
But it costs less than State Street costs.
Maybe. We don't know. I mean, you would... I don't know what that bottom dollar is to buy the utility. But what I do know is that it's not as simple. It's not like buying a house. It's not like you could go out there and condemn property and say, we're going to take this. There's a little bit more involved in that. But the fact of the matter is that number, whatever it be, whether it be $40 million, $60 million, or $100 million, would be paid over an extended period of time. And when you're looking at a way to purchase things, when you're looking at a way to bond things, the actual product, whether it be a road or whether it be a utility or whether it be a bunch of land to do some stuff, the people that are providing those bonds to you are the ones that go ahead and make that determination. And then you make a determination as to how long it would take for you to pay them back. So the reality of it is, and again, that's a long-winded way of saying the fact of the matter is it's the expense isn't necessarily as important as the timeline and the amount of payments and what you negotiate and then even if it would be supported.
Well, but realistically, you can only take out so much bond issuance at a time. Mm-hmm. And so you've already asked for as much as $78 million in bond authority for State Street. And that would seem to curtail your ability to bond out a similar large project like this that's going to take tens of millions of more dollars, right?
Well, not necessarily, no, because we'll use that schedule based upon our ability to pay. And we are using one specific TIF and a specific amount of money to make that payment because it doesn't bankrupt the TIF. I know that there's been some conversations. Actually, during the campaign season, there were some folks that were saying that we're going to spend all of our money on State Street and we can't provide police protection and we can't plow streets and we can't. Well, no, that's not true at all. We knew exactly how much money we were going to spend, how much it was going to impact our overall budget, and what impact it would have on operations. Which is
all right. Well, Mr. Mayor, we've run out of time, but thanks as always for your time, and we'll do it again in February.
All right. I really enjoy this. Thanks, Dan.
Remember to tune in next week for our conversation with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski, and you can find all these conversations archived online at our website. That's WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for Ask the Mayor on WBAA comes from your membership and Butler, Fairman & Seifert, a civil engineering firm providing communities with professional expertise and guidance. Butler, Fairman & Seifert, civil engineering solutions for better communities. BFSENGR.com.